I'm John Krall. Today, on this special recorded No Limits, we're going to talk with Alelia Bundles. She is the author, most recently, of the children's book All About Madam C.J. Walker. We're going to talk with her about Madam C.J. Walker and about the hidden history of Indiana, Indianapolis, and the United States. Because this is a recorded program, we are not able to take calls, emails, or questions or comments via social media. But we do hope that you enjoy the conversation. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. This is a special pre-recorded version of No Limits, and because it is pre-recorded, we're not able to take questions, but we do hope you enjoy the conversation. We're going to be talking with Alelia Bundles, who is the author most recently of All About Madam C.J. Walker. It's actually her fourth book about Madam C.J. Walker. First, though, I should welcome you to the program.
Delighted to be here. Thank you for having me.
It is good to have you here. So talk with me about, you know, your fascination with Madam C.J. Walker, where that started and what drives it.
So when I was growing up on Grandview Drive, my mother went to work every day at the Walker Building on Indiana Avenue. So that was really my first introduction. And the silverware that we used every day had Madam Walker's monogram on it. But Madam Walker was not the center of my universe. We didn't sit at dinner talking about her. And as a kid, I was, you know, not any more interested in her story than anybody else. But I became fascinated with her daughter, Alelia Walker, my namesake, who Langston Hughes called the Joy Goddess of Harlem's 1920s. So in my black history class that I lobbied for at North Central in the late 60s, I wrote about Alelia Walker. It really wasn't until graduate school in journalism that one of my professors, Phyllis Garland, basically said, you need to write about your great-great-grandmother.
And that connection, was that part of your growing up? I mean, were there stories that were passed down?
Yeah, there were stories. And, you know, I mean, I, you know, again, my mother was at the Walker Building every day, so I knew who Madam Walker was, and I knew what other people thought about her. But it was really, Phil Garland was the only African-American professor at Columbia's Journalism School. And when we met to talk about what I was going to write about, I gave her some very cliched story lines, and she just kind of looked at me. And at the end of the conversation, she said, your name is Alelia. Do you have any connection to Madam Walker and Alelia Walker? Now, I know Phil knew the answer to that because her mother had been an editor at the Pittsburgh Courier, and she had worked at Ebony and Jet, but she didn't want to just put it on me. Mm-hmm. And I said, yeah, that's my family. And she said, well, that's what you're going to write about. And it was a critical moment. It was the fall of 1975. My mother was in the hospital here in Indianapolis with lung cancer terminal. And I came home and I interviewed my mother, got some stories from her. My grandfather had lots of stories. He had saved lots of things, books, clothes, letters. We had this amazing body of letters between Madam Walker and her attorney, F.B. Ransom, that are now at the Indiana Historical Society. So really with Phil's kind of push to me, I began to research Madam Walker. And then I began to discover that she wasn't just about hair, which is what the pigeonhole other people mm-hmm. had put her into. I began to discover that she was a political activist and a patron of the arts and a pioneer of the modern hair care industry. So then I began to really embrace that story because it inspired other people.
And I'm fascinated by this because I think I would find it very difficult to approach a story about, in part because I have done some writing about my own grandparents, great-grandparents, and all of that, summoning up the detachment mm-hmm. on that's necessary to tell the story is not effortless. What kind of challenges did you have to surmount to do that?
My initial answer was, as you were saying that, I'm like, well, you know, it's five generations ago. Maybe it's not that hard. But, you know, that's actually, I'm glad you asked it in that way because there were some challenges for me.
Yeah, the blood still flows through your
veins. Yeah, exactly. So, you know, it was a very fraught period in the late 60s about hair. We're still dealing with the fraught thing about hair.
For some of us, it's right. Not as much. I'm a follically challenged man.
Better Walker could have helped you. But my mother was vice president of the Walker Company, and my dad was president of Summit Laboratories. My father, Henry Bundles, a lot of Indianapolis people know him because he was the first president of Center for Leadership Development. Yeah. But he was president of Summit Labs. So they both were in the hair care business. But my father's company focused on chemical hair straighteners. So like most young black girls my age, at that point my hair was chemically straightened. That's what everybody did in the late 60s. And then the Afro emerged, and I wanted an Afro. I wanted to make a political statement. I was, you know, becoming politically radicalized, but proud and all of that. And my father was really, really against that. Now, we laugh about that now, but that connects to Madam Walker because in many people's minds, Madam Walker had... People used to say, Madam Walker invented the hot comb, and she wanted black people to straighten their hair. Well, I was absorbing what other people were saying. She did not invent the hot comb, and her primary goal was having healthy hair at a time when people didn't have the same, you know, hygiene and all of that. So I was conflicted about her. I was ambivalent about Madam Walker. So that's why I was more fascinated with her daughter than Madam Walker. But it really took me doing my own research about her to figure out, I like these parts of her that are politically, you know, more politically involved, that she was spied upon by a black spy at the War Department during World War I, along with Ida B. Wells Barnett and Marcus Garvey, because she was considered a Negro subversive. So that spoke to, you know, who I am and the things that I'm interested in. So yeah, there was, you know, there was some ambivalence that I had because I was interpreting her through the myth that other people had created about her.
Well, and you mentioned, obviously, that, you know, at the time that you started on this journey, there was only one African-American faculty member in Columbia's journalism school. And in many other areas of media, and obviously African-Americans were horribly underrepresented as well. Was it difficult to get people first to take you seriously, because you were a young woman in addition to being African-American, and then also to get them to take the subject seriously?
You know, I think nobody else in that faculty would have recognized my weird A apostrophe capital L name, you know, but if you knew anything black history, you recognize it. So only Phyllis Garland would have picked up on that. You know, when I wrote that story, Phyllis really validated that for me. But there was nobody saying, hey, write a book about this. You know, that was 1975. Roots was about to come out. You know, that was a blockbuster. But, you know, that was a period of time when Alice Walker would have a book, and 3 years later, Toni Morrison would have a book. So there were just, people may have been thinking about books, but nobody was publishing.
And every 40 years, Ralph Ellison
would
do one.
Exactly. So, you know, so yes, there, you know, it wasn't something that people were clamoring for. Now, then once, in fact, I even had a black bookseller tell me 10 years later when I was writing it, well, who's going to read that? But I knew that that story needed to be told. I knew there was a power there. But no, absolutely, it was not something that people were knocking my door down for.
If you're just joining us, we are talking with Alelia Bundles about her most recent book, a children's book about Madam C.J. Walker. It's called All About Madam C.J. Walker. This is a recorded program, so you're not able to join the conversation, but we do hope you're enjoying the discussion. So there was some resistance. You talked about getting some validation. How did you go about ultimately persuading people, no, this is not only a story I want to tell, but it's an important story and that I am well suited to tell it?
So there are lots of little things that have happened along the way because we did have this great body of letters. And one of Madam Walker's secretaries was still living when I was growing up, Violet Reynolds, in her 80s, early 90s. And she had squirreled away all these letters. Well, those letters were donated to the Indiana Historical Society in the early 1980s. In 1984, Alex Haley came to us, or actually maybe 85, came to us and said he wanted to write about Madam Walker. He wanted to do a miniseries. And so I had already written this master's paper at Columbia, you know, pathetic as it was when I now look back at it. But I ended up doing research for what we thought was going to be Alex's miniseries. I was on the Radcliffe College Trustees Board, and Nathan Huggins, who was a professor and the first head of the Du Bois Institute at Harvard, mm-hmm. was the senior consulting editor for Chelsea House Publishing. They were doing Black Americans of mm-hmm. Achievement. He knew I was working with Alex and doing the research, so he helped me write that first children's book. So bit by bit, the children's book was easy because I knew the senior consulting mm-hmm. editor. The next step to write the much more comprehensive book on mm-hmm. her own ground was much harder. I had to hire an agent, and we, you know, had to persuade people. And I got very lucky on that because there's, you know, there's mm-hmm. luck and preparation. I had met Alex Haley's editor, Lisa Drew, on his farm. And Lisa was one of the people we pitched the book to. She already understood the power of the story because Alex had told her of the power of the story. So, and he had died by that time. But Lisa is the person who bought the book. And that, you know, so it was like the little angels were there to try to make this happen.
Obviously, the people you were talking with would have understood the importance of Madam C.J. Walker. Mm-hmm. And we're going to talk more about her significance in not just Indiana history, but American history and world history a little later in the conversation. But she is part of kind of that invisible history of our state and our country. And book publishers often can be very conservative and not necessarily want to publish something if they don't see a return. How did you go about selling them that this is a story people are going to want to read?
Well, you know, Lisa sold it to her, you know, to her bosses, and that was helpful. But, you know, even now people will tell me, like, yeah, I had something that was published recently on Howls.com, H-O-U-Z-Z.com. It's mm-hmm. like an HDTV thing about Madam Walker's mansion in Irvington, New York, which is a National Historic Landmark. Mm-hmm. And there were people in the comments section, I never heard about her. Or I've heard about her, I didn't realize she had so many dimensions. So even now, there are people who are just discovering Madam Walker because we don't learn these stories in school. But I think we are at an amazing moment where women's stories are very important. You know, my book has, on her own ground, has been optioned for a Netflix series. So Octavia Spencer mm-hmm. will be playing Madam Walker. LeBron James is an executive producer. So we have, you know, so it's
been... You mean you couldn't find some star power right. here?
But I had some really, I had a lot of missed, you know, a lot of sort of potholes to get to this point.
Yeah.
But, you know, we just really believed it was going to happen over time. But so now people will know once that happens. But yes, all along the way, there have been people who are like, well, I don't really know if it's that important. We had a tough time with Hollywood for decades. You know, the old story before, you know, Black Panther and The Butler and 12 Years a Slave, nobody's going to see movies with black people in them. So we're now past that point. We know that that's not true. But yes, there were many, the long time, like, when nobody will believe her story. It's not, it's too... you know, amazing. It's like, well, this is a real story. But yeah, a real challenge with people who just sort of dismissed it or didn't think that it would have a wide enough audience.
What surprised you in doing the research? I mean, you had the family stories.
Right.
But, you know, we all tend to look at our parents, our grandparents, through that lens, really, of childhood and then realize, oh, there are these entire other dimensions
right.
to them.
Well, because her story was just, you know, it was sort of the myth and the myth that she created and the myth that the company created. Born on a plantation in Delta, Louisiana in 1867, orphaned at 7, married at 14 to get a home of her own to escape the treatment of a cruel brother-in-law, mother at 17, widowed at 20, washerwoman till she was 38, millionaire when she died. So that was like the, you know, 30-second story.
And millionaire really is the equivalent of almost a billionaire.
Exactly,
today.
Exactly. Yeah. So that was kind of the story that other people, you know, sort of people who knew something, I knew that story. But when I really began to delve into her life, there are a couple of things that are important to me. One, where she was born in Louisiana was the staging area for the Siege of Vicksburg for Sherman and Grant. Mm-hmm. That meant I had tons of research at the National Archives that I could find and reconfigure and figure out what was going on. Her family minister was a black state senator in Louisiana. Now, I don't know if she ever had any conversations with him because she was a child, but that said something to me about what had forged her mm-hmm. early life that I was able to piece together. She moved to St. Louis in the 1880s and 1890s. It was a booming town. It was ragtime. she went to an AME church, African Methodist Episcopal Church, those kinds of things. She was mentored by the church women. Those things that weren't part of that sort of quick little synopsis, that told me more about her. And then the thing that really fascinated me was just how politically active she became and what a philanthropist she became. She was very involved in very progressive, you know, really radical sort of Black Lives Matter 1.0 kinds of activities. And I really loved learning that about her, that she self-educated, but as she had money, she really connected herself to people like W.E.B. Du Bois and James Weldon Johnson and Monroe Trotter and Ida B. Wells Barnett. They had maybe more education than she did, but she was able to translate her desire to help her community into working with these people and to use their political power.
We are talking with Alila Bundles about her most recent book about her great-grandmother, Madam C.J. Walker. It's a children's book called All About Madam C.J. Walker. This is a recorded program, which means we're not able to take questions or comments, but we hope you're enjoying the conversation. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please, stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're talking today with Alila Bundles about her great-grandmother, Madam C.J. Walker. She has written 4 books and probably numerous articles about Madam C.J. Walker. The most recent of them came out just last year and is a children's book called All About Madam C.J. Walker. Now, you know, this is a difficult line because there are people who are listening to this program who doubtless know all about Madam C.J. Walker, but there are going to be some who aren't familiar with the story. And until then, there wasn't... Probably the closest parallel we can think of today would be Oprah, mm-hmm. right? Where same sort of rags-to-riches story, overcoming tremendous obstacles along the way, and exerting this tremendous influence, not just in the world of business, but, as you say, in philanthropy and activism and political involvement. You've studied her. Mm-hmm. Where do you think the drive came from?
You know, it is the who inspired her, because this is like a child who's orphaned at 7 and who's abused by the brother-in-law, and she would only sort of say in this official company history, my cruel brother-in-law. I got married at 14 to get a home of my own to escape my cruel brother-in-law. And we don't know what that really means, but she was abused in some kind of way and, you know, abandoned at a really early age. But it's that child who's resilient. But I also think some of it is this, what was going on in that community. This family minister who was a Black state senator, her older brothers were chased out of the state along with this family minister because they were so radical. They were chased mm-hmm. out of the state by the Ku Klux Klan. That's in Senate hearing records mm-hmm. that I can read this. So there's documentation on it. But they then moved to St. Louis and became barbers. So while, you know, most Black men who would have been in cities were laborers, they were barbers. They weren't wealthy, but they had a little bit more agency, to mm-hmm. use that word, which I kind of don't like, but agency, a little sort of, you know, self awareness in the city. And I think she learned from them. But I also think that just that survival instinct that she had to hone at such an early age translated to surviving in the city. And then it really was the kind of mentoring of these women, the club women, the church women, who saw that she had some drive and really encouraged it. So you see a person who's basically an illiterate washerwoman trying to raise a child, and these women in the city see her. I mean, essentially she was an immigrant, you know, and it's like, what happens when somebody moves to an entirely new environment and somebody sees a spark in them? And instead of looking at them and saying, you know, go away, you know, you don't have as much education as I do, these women kind of embraced her and began to empower her, to lift her up. So I think she had that resilience, but I think it was nurtured by women who really saw something in her.
That whole resilience question is one, because it's obviously it's a question that preoccupies us today with young people. I mean, very easily we can think of her story as being a tragedy, you know, where a young woman is just completely broken and shattered. Did you get a sense from all of the research you've done when, and I'm trying to recall it in a biography, not of Madam C.J. Walker, but of another figure who said that, oh, I think it was Lincoln, actually, said that the great mystery with him was the moment when, not just when he began to realize that he might be every bit as good as everybody else, but maybe even just a little bit better and smarter. Do you have some sense of when that moment occurred for her, when she began to realize, no, I am not trapped by the limitations of my time and culture?
You know, two things come to mind, and it's, and I guess there probably are many other things, but to her, two of her marriages, so the first husband died. That's a, you know, another thing. The second marriage was to a man who, you know, just same station in life, a laborer, but he was a drunk, and he had girlfriends, and, you know, they're probably both making 50 cents a day, but he's not coming home. And he was, he beat her up. I mean, that was bad. It was, that was what her life was, and those women of the church kind of, you know, helped pull her away from that. And then she married Charles Joseph Walker, hence Madam C.J. Walker, after she had moved to Denver, and she was already beginning to start selling hair care products. And that seemed to be the right, they were both ambitious, but she was more ambitious than he was. And she said, you know, when I began to make 50 cents a day, my husband thought that was enough, or maybe $10 a week, he thought that was enough, but I knew I had something that could be much bigger. And he was happy to just make enough to, you know, to get by. But she saw that she was influencing other women. That it was, yes, she was teaching women how to do her Madam Walker system, wash your hair, apply this ointment that contains sulfur, heal the sores on your scalp, now your hair can grow. That was Madam Walker's wonderful hair grower. But she saw that when she helped these women transform themselves, and when they could make a little bit of extra money selling the product, that she was doing something that was making a difference in their lives. So I think that's when she really began to see, this is not just about me selling a little tin of Madam Walker's wonderful hair grower. This is about me being able to help other people transform their lives.
So was it that realization, you think, that, because obviously she started as a tremendous success in business, but then, again, using kind of the Oprah parallel, became a cultural force, became a political force, and really one of the first great advocates for not just African-American empowerment, but female empowerment.
Right. Yeah, you know, and there are just little things, like she sang in the choir, even when she was the poor washerwoman. She had enough of a voice, and that choir traveled around St. Louis. So she was getting that sort of nurturing and learning, you know, bit by bit. But then she began to outstrip the teachers, and you could really see that begin to happen.
When you were researching her, I mean, at what point were you able to drop sort of, okay, this is my great grandmother, and see her as a human being, as, you know.
You know, this is, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that there's enough distance. But here's a really key thing for me. When I came home from Columbia for Christmas vacation, and my mother was in the hospital at Methodist Hospital, and she was really not, she didn't have chemotherapy, she didn't have a lot of energy to really, you know, answer all my questions. But I said to her, I said, so, Mommy, I'm starting to find that Madam Walker's not perfect. You know, there's some divorces, there's some other, you know, flaws. I didn't know the full extent of flaws even at that point. But, you know, that's, she's not, you know, perfect. And my mother sitting in the hospital bed said, tell the truth, baby. It's all right to tell the truth. And that was really one of the last conversations I had with my mother. She died about a week and a half later. That freed me up to tell the story. So when I discovered that Madam Walker hadn't really divorced the second husband, you know, and that she wasn't perfect and that she, you know, sometimes had some spats with her agents, that she had worked for a while selling products for Annie Malone, who became her fiercest competitor, and she just sort of left that out of the story, though she far outstripped Malone. You know, those were things I was, you know, I discovered new information about that, and I thought it had to be in the story. I mean, and I also thought to tell the story about somebody who's larger than life and other people admire, you have to say there are flaws, because if there are no flaws,
They're not human.
Then they're not human, and then other people think that they could not be that. So you have to, you know, everybody has flaws, and everybody makes mistakes, and it's how you correct the mistakes that is the measure of the person.
Where I'm trying to go with this is, I'm thinking of a phrase from one of Ivan Doig's books about James Gilchrist Swan, who was a pioneer in the Pacific Northwest, and he talked about how one man writing in the late 1970s, early 1980s about another who was a 19th century figure, and how there's this sense of kinship that develops through the study, a relationship. And I guess I'd like to ask, when you began to feel that sense of connection with her and what brought it about? Maybe what were the moments when you were looking at her that you felt the closest to her?
So, you know, a lot of my writing early on was like 2 or 3 in the morning when you start to hear the voices of people. And I think it was really that political stuff. It was really discovering that she had a fight with Booker T. Washington. There's a transcript of her speech at the 1912 National Negro Business League Convention. She wanted Booker T. Washington to acknowledge her, and he wouldn't. And there is the actual transcript where she just, on the last day of the convention, stands up and says, because he's refused to let her talk, "Surely you're not going to shut the door in my face." I'm like, wow. I had no idea that she was that forceful, that she was speaking truth to power. So that was really a key connection for me. You know, another thing, it's really, I think about this also with her daughter, because I do have all of these letters. And the daughter is who I identified with. I mean, our birthdays are one day apart. I had the same name. But she had a problematic relationship with her mother. I mean, their secretary said to me, I said, "What was their relationship like?" She said, "Fire and ice." And then she said it over, "Fire and ice." They loved each other fiercely, and they sometimes fought fiercely. So I knew that there was that relationship between the women, and that Madam Walker really spoiled her daughter, loved her daughter, was apologetic almost to her daughter about having put her through so much as a child, and now spoiled her. But that relationship between the two and the tug and pull made me connect to them. Now, I had a really great relationship with my mother, so I didn't have that kind of thing, but I could see where that how that affected the two of them. And then with Alelia Walker, because I knew she hadn't lived up to her mother's expectations, or really, maybe she lived up to her mother's expectations, but the world expected her as the daughter of a really powerful, famous person to be a certain way. And so I felt empathy for her. And as I'm writing a biography of her now, I feel empathy. And I have to catch myself, because I don't want to be an apologist for what she did or didn't do, but I understand the pressure that other people put on her. So for both of them, with Madam Walker, I connected with her when I saw that she was speaking up and fighting people who were more powerful and that she had courage. And with her daughter, I connect when I see that I want to have empathy for what other people expected of her that she wasn't able to deliver.
What was the hardest part of writing the story?
All the information. Yeah. You know, it's just like, I have so much stuff. Two rooms in my house are filled with the research, and it's, you know, it is the what to take out and what to leave in. Actually, I think writing Madam Walker's story, her arc is such an obvious arc of the rags to riches, and then she blossoms and she's multidimensional. With her daughter, it's more complicated, because there's not the central accomplishment. Mm-hmm. And so I have lots of stories where she knew everybody, from Zora Neale Hurston to Langston Hughes to Count A. Cullen and James Weldon Johnson. And so it's like figuring out what the central part, what the story is.
Really rich cultural history right there. Again, I was thinking of Robert Lincoln, mm-hmm. who was, I think, in the cabinet for a couple of other presidents, which would be considered, a great and significant career for anyone else. But, if you're the son of the president who saved the Union, you're considered a failure
exactly.
as a result.
Exactly.
Same
what
sort
can
of
you do? What
dynamic
can
that there's no way to live up to that. Sounds like you want to tell that other Alila story more fully than you have so far.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so I am 23 chapters into what I think is a 30-chapter book, so I'm not quite finished with it. But I have learned a lot and a lot about the period. The Harlem Renaissance, everybody mentions her when they write about it, but I know what she was doing every day, and really I'm telling a story of the social fabric of the Harlem Renaissance, the relationships between people, and it's sort of not just the literary figures. But, the Harlem Renaissance would have been really different without Alila Walker and her parties. And some people sort of dismiss her as, she gave great parties. But the parties really brought people together. She was the one who had the money to host these events. She had the first showing of Augusta Savage's artwork, and Augusta Savage went on to become one of the most renowned sculptors of the 20th century. But it was her salon where Augusta Savage displayed her work.
Why do you think they're so dismissive of her as opposed to, like Sylvia Beach, with the Lost Generation?
Right. Well, it was the comparison to her mother. So W.E.B. Du Bois, who was my intellectual hero, was very complimentary about Madame Walker, but dismissive of Alila Walker because she was not so as uptight as he was, even though I loved Du Bois on many levels. But he saw her as, sort of frittering away her mother's fortune. And in fact, she didn't do it, but that's kind of the rap on her. But her mother was involved with the NAACP, with the leadership. Alila Walker had other interests. She was a patron of the arts. She was much more interested in that. So he really kind of defined her for much of the reading public, and people knew that she wasn't doing all of the same things in business that her mother was doing. Therefore, they didn't consider her as serious a person. But she made a big difference, and the story I'm trying to tell.
Is it sort of the traditional rap often on second generation wealth too?
Absolutely,
played out.
Absolutely.
That because she hadn't climbed the mountain herself.
And there is, and there is definitely some truth to that. There's no question. It's like the first generation, earns, the second generation spends. But then there was the complication of the Depression, so that, it's just like it was not entirely her fault. But my godmother, a woman named Marjorie Joyner, who was principal of the Walker Schools and who lived almost to 100, her take on it, because Mrs. Reynolds, the secretary, was sitting here in Indianapolis judging Alila Walker in Harlem. My godmother, Marjorie Joyner, said, Alila did what her mother wanted her to do. She wanted her to enjoy the money. She wanted her to have a good time. Now, she also wanted her to work hard, and she might have been a little disappointed in that part of her. But I think she worked hard so that her daughter would not have to work as hard. Now, that can be a little trap for the next generation, because everybody needs to learn how to earn their own money, and they need to make their own contributions.
We are talking with Alila Bundles about her most recent book about her great-grandmother, Madam C.J. Walker. It's called All About Madam C.J. Walker. It's a children's book that came out last year. But we're really talking more about larger questions of American, particularly African-American history here on No Limits Today. This is a recorded program. That means we're not able to take messages via social media. We hope you're enjoying the conversation. We're going to come back in just a bit and talk a little more with Alila Bundles about larger questions of invisible history. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. In this special recorded No Limits, we are talking with Alelia Bundles. She is the author most recently of All About Madam C.J. Walker, a book about her great-grandmother, a children's book that came out last year. Because this is a recorded program, we're not able to take calls or emails or messages via social media. We hope, though, that you are enjoying the conversation. So we've talked about Madam C.J. Walker, and I want to talk now about a subject we were talking about before we went on the air, which is why so much of this really fascinating and important part of human history isn't often part of the historical record. Why is it that there are still relatively few people who know about Madam C.J. Walker?
Yeah, well, because, you know, the scholarship has exploded in really the last, in my lifetime, in the last 40 to almost 50 years, where women's history, African-American history, ethnic studies, people are getting their PhDs in history mm-hmm. departments throughout the United States. And before that, you know, it was really hard to get a history department professor to take your dissertation topic seriously if it wasn't about European history or if it wasn't about, you know, American presidents.
Dead white males.
Dead white males. But scholarship has really made a huge difference in what's being taught. So, I will say I had a fabulous education in Washington Township. Mm-hmm. I went to Grandview, I went to West Lane, I went to North Central. I had some really, really great teachers. But the history textbooks of the late 1960s were really horrible when it came to teaching race. They were, you know, slavery was taught as something that was sort of a benevolent evil. It's just sort of a mistake in American history and not something that was central to the economy, that it wasn't the greatest driver of wealth in America up until the Civil War. So that what I learned and what I have written about in an essay for a new book edited by Rochelle Riley called The Burden, African Americans and the Enduring Impact of Slavery, what I wrote about was my high school textbook. And I had this memory because I was at North Central. My memory is that I was the only black kid in this history class, and that there was black people were mentioned in the textbook maybe once or twice. And the memory that I had carried with me for decades was that there was a paragraph that said, the slaves were contented and they were better off enslaved than free. Now, sometimes you misremember things.
Well, but that, you know, I mean, that was the kind of argument that slaveholders advanced in the days before
the Civil
War.
And that was the way history was taught. Now, when I began to...
To some degree, that also was the implied thesis for Gone with the Wind.
Exactly,
too.
And, you know, and women didn't exist in the book. So when I began to do the research to write the essay for Rochelle's book, I was struggling to find the textbook. Nobody in Washington Township had any list of the textbooks. I called the library, I called the superintendent's office, all of that stuff. Nobody could find it. But a friend of mine who is at Harvard and across the street from the education school said the education school had the database of approved textbooks for all the states from the mid-20th century. They found the textbook that had been approved for North Central and for Washington Township. And they scanned the pages for me. And lo and behold, there actually is a paragraph that says that. And I'm like, I cannot believe this. So there I felt myself back in that class, totally embarrassed, knowing that this, in my gut, that this wasn't true.
Yeah.
But I didn't have anything to fight back with. But through my research through the years, I read W.E.B. Du Bois as The Souls of Black Folk a few months after that. And that gave me some way to understand the sort of structural racism. But then I didn't know at the time. I didn't know about Frederick Douglass. I didn't know about resistance. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that my grandmother's family had been free people of color in North Carolina in the 1700s and 1800s, and that she'd had two great-great-grandfathers who had been in the Continental Army. So I'm a member mm-hmm. of the DAR. I didn't know about that. I didn't know that my maternal grandfather's grandmother, great-grandmother, had been the daughter of the slaveholder, but had been freed in 1839 because he had promised to free her. So those kinds of stories that are real American stories were not available to me to fight back in that class. But I still think the same thing is going on. We, you know, if we don't know our history, it means other people have myths about us and we have no confidence in ourselves.
How do we alter that? I mean, I'm thinking about when we were talking just a couple of minutes ago about the Harlem Renaissance and all of that. You know, there are what, probably a dozen books every year that come out about Paris in the 20s.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, a similarly explosive period of cultural creativity, the Harlem Renaissance, is lucky to have, what, one book every 20 years, something like
that?
Well,
no, there's a lot now. Actually, there's a lot. But that is sort of a period that gets written about. But there's so much other stuff that doesn't. Yeah. No, and, you know, just the appreciation of it, or if somebody writes about it, how much, who reviews it, you know, how much attention does it get when there are all of these stories that we should know? I mean, we don't know, most people don't know that the greatest wealth in America in the 1860s was human bodies,
mm-hmm.
greater than the railroads, greater than banks. But that means that the American economy was built on the bodies of enslaved people, and it still has an effect on our economy, what the foundation was. But we want to have amnesia about those things and say, well, that doesn't really matter. Get over it.
Mm-hmm. And, yeah, I mean, obviously it's still an ongoing issue to this day when we talk about reparations and all of that. What are the areas of history you think still need to be plumbed?
Mm-hmm. Well, listen, here in Indianapolis, I mean, you did a show where you talked about gentrification in Indianapolis. So I just know, I grew up on Grandview Drive, but my church was at 25th and Paris, and our church was torn down when the highway came through.
Yeah.
Segregation in schools in Indianapolis. I mean, people have done research. They're writing about what happens when the freeways went through and what happened with segregation, and everybody knows the story about Crispus Attucks winning, you know, the championship and not being able to have the parade. Ray Crow, mm-hmm. Their coach was our neighbor. You know, mm-hmm. I was at their house every day after school. So we sort of know some of these stories, but there are other little things. So just to study Indianapolis, Indianapolis is, you know, really a great community in many, many ways, but we also need to know that history. When my parents and other families built homes in an all-black neighborhood on Grandview Drive between Kessler and 64th Street, sort of that area, they could not get loans from banks.
Mm-hmm.
Most of those men were veterans of World War II. They were eligible for loans. They went to a black insurance company to get banks. But that's how that neighborhood was built. You know, Paul Mullins has done tons of research on this.
Mm-hmm.
But those are the kinds of stories to know how our city was created and how our city is a microcosm. People survived. They, you know, our parents didn't burden us with, you know, the details of that. You were just supposed to do well in school and, you know, get a job and contribute to your community. But we need to know that the strength that came from having to overcome those obstacles, but also not to repeat those things again.
Yeah, there are parts I think I will tell students periodically that Indianapolis was a segregated city. Mm-hmm. Riverside Park, for example.
Oh, yeah.
African Americans could not go into. I guess, because there are people who advance that argument you're talking about, that it happened long ago, get over it.
Right.
We've had an African American president.
Yes, what?
So all of the problems are solved. We're in a post-racial society now. Let's talk a bit about why it is so important to acknowledge those parts of our past mm-hmm. and to come to terms with them.
Yeah, it's just empathy. It's sort of understanding the, you know, walking in somebody else's shoes. And I think, you know, this is going to sound like a generalization, but I think, you know, many black Americans sort of understand their position in the larger society. I'm not sure the larger society understands what has gone on to help create the strength of African Americans. And that people still can see, because now our media is so polarized, our politics is so polarized, people can have a stereotype of somebody and they have seen one thing and that becomes the entire black community. As opposed to if they knew, you know, more than one black person, they might say there's a whole range of people. You know, in some ways, Black Panther kind of shows that, that there's not a monolith. I don't know that people will necessarily get that message, but just the different tribes represent different perspectives on things. But if we need to know each other, I mean, it just seems so basic. And I guess it's frustrating to me, you know, that 65, that some of the same conversations that I was having when I was in high school about if people just knew each other, they would get along. But I guess I'm skeptical about that. But I want that to be true.
Is there, as you were talking, I was thinking of, and I've told this story over the air before, the late Len Ford, who was an Indianapolis Star reporter and columnist at the same time that I was there, and I were friends. We had our desks beside each other in the newsroom for a while, and the other thing that we had in common is that we were both huge Elvis fans, and we threw, you know, you knew Lynn, so you know this about him.
He did a really nice column on that.
And I'm grateful to you because you're forcing me to think of him, and it's a pleasant memory. But I remember we decided we were going to throw an Elvis party together once, which we did. And another friend of ours, who should have known better, came up to Len and said, I kid you not, do black people like Elvis? And Len, you know, who was not slow by any stretch of imagination, just looked at him and says, I don't know. I do. You'll have to go ask the rest of us.
Exactly.
But it gets to that sort of monolithic impression that we have of each other if we don't understand the varieties of this human experience. And understand, for example, that, you know, the story you're telling, that Madam C.J. Walker and Booker T. Washington, and, you know, that they could be at odds.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's, and it is, what, you know, what it is that people find in common. When being at North Central in the late 60s, it was like 4% black. It was really, you know, really small percentage. But there were friendships that were forged. There are friendships that I still have, people that I'm still in touch with. But I also realized that when I was elected vice president of student council on April 4th, 1968. Then later that evening, we know Martin Luther King was assassinated, that there were some white parents who called the school to complain. But there was a cocoon of administrators and teachers and friends who didn't let that become the defining moment for me. That there are always people, there are always allies, and you have to reach out to them. But, you know, everybody doesn't have that experience. Again, we're so polarized and we're so segregated even now. There are some people who get to have the wide range of experience and they get to know people from other cultures. But there are a lot of people who live their everyday lives and only see what they see on television or see a stereotype with somebody who's screaming at them on the television or the radio.
And who fear that other.
And who fear that other. Who make up stories.
About the other.
About the other.
So, with all of this work that you have done, what do you ultimately hope that that people will take away from not just the research and the books you've done on Madam C.J. Walker, but, you know, the larger body of your work?
You know, I on a really basic level, I love that Madam Walker still inspires people 150 years after she was born. So that means a lot to me. But it's also a platform that allows me to encourage other women, to encourage young people. You know, I will answer an email from a fifth grader as quickly as I will go talk to the students at Harvard Business School. I just love being able to use this story to talk about business, entrepreneurship, activism, philanthropy, giving back to your community. And I think one of the main things that I've learned from Madam Walker, everybody wants to talk about the being the millionaire. That's great. I love that little piece. But, you know, I often forget to even mention that. What I love is that she used that power and that influence to make a difference. And everything is not about money. A lot of it is about giving back and making yourself available to other people. So I just want people to know it's if you make the money, use that money for good. And even if you don't make a lot of money, do good.
So your next book, the one that you're 23 chapters,
23
I think you said.
Chapters,
you said you were
and a really overdue deadline.
Okay. Glad I'm not the only one. When do you anticipate that will be out? And do you have a working title?
So, The Joy Goddess of Harlem, okay. Alelia Walker and the Harlem Renaissance, since Langston Hughes called her the Joy Goddess of Harlem. So my hope is that this book will be out in 2019. My hope is that the Netflix series starring Octavia Spencer about Madam Walker will be out in 2019. But those things, I hope, will all come together so that the publisher can then have two books that they're selling.
To push at the same time.
At the same time.
And how far along do you anticipate that we are from knowing definitely about the Netflix?
The Netflix series has Casey Lemons is the director, Octavia Spencer is the star. The writers' team has just been assembled and will be meeting within the next couple of weeks. So then they start outlining the 8 to 10 episodes.
And will it be just a contained limited series? Right. Are they going to do?
Limited series, and then I'm hoping that it will, if it is successful, that they will then option The Joy Goddess of Harlem.
And do the second one. Okay.
But we'll see.
Well, I hope, and I say this sincerely, you'll come back and talk with us again.
You must have me.
We would love to have you back. You tell great stories. And it's a fascinating subject. So I really do want to thank you for making the time to talk with us and also for sharing not just your great-grandmother's story, but your own story.
Thank you.
So
always a joy to be in my hometown and really a pleasure to be with you.
Well, we have been talking with Alelia Bundles. She is the author most recently of the children's book All About Madam C.J. Walker, which is the story of her great-grandmother. This has been a recorded program, so we haven't been able to take emails, phone calls, or social media messages, but we hope you've enjoyed the conversation. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producers, Sarah Neal Estes, Roxana Caldwell, and Jill Sheridan. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. Emily Matheny screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.